Hello, hello, hello. My name is Michelle Zeman, and I am your host of Safe Space, the ABA podcast. I'm super excited about this episode, but before we dive right into it, be sure to listen up for the code words. Those code words get you free CEUs. So today I'm super excited to be hosting alongside Jenny Northern. She is an amazing BCBA and an SLP, and on Instagram, she is known as at Jenny Northern Services. Welcome to the podcast, Jenny.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited. So I have been listening and trying to catch up because I was behind on some of your episodes, and I just feel like I need to say that your intro music is so fun.
Oh, thank you so much. I love it.
I love it because I'm like, you know, usually when I'm listening to podcasts, I'm in my car or I'm cooking and I'm like, okay. Yeah. And it's your ending music too, right?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. It's really good. I love it.
Thank you.
I think it's just exciting to have more opportunities of free CEUs through podcasts. Cause we have to have so many, especially being duly certified. I have to have so many throughout the year for SLP and BCBA. It just really helps me out.
Yeah. I was going to say, how many do you have to have for SLP?
So it's actually 10 a year. So, you know, BCBA is 12 a year. So I have to have 22 a year. Sometimes they overlap, but a lot of times, sometimes they don't. So, cause one time I tried to overlap it and then I got audited. So I'm like, okay, I'm just going to keep trying. Keep them separate because so there's just no questions. And so pretty much 22 a year is what I'm looking for on that, which it's fun because learn a lot, but just don't ever want to get behind. So I try to stay up to date on it.
Oh, absolutely. Oh my goodness. That's a lot to keep up with. I can only imagine.
Yep.
Oh my goodness. Well, Jenny, tell me a little bit about your story. Tell me how you got into the field and also how you got speech and ABA sort of like married into each other.
Yes. Okay. So I started out as speech. So I went to school basically kind of not really knowing what I wanted to do, but I know I loved the medical field. And this is where I never even heard of speech therapy. And so kind of just meeting with your advisory and figuring out what you want. And I kind of actually really thought I was going to go the OT route until I heard they had to do gross anatomy. And I was like, I cannot on a good to ever do that. So that's basically what made my decision between OT and speech. And I loved it. As soon as I graduated, I really thought that I was going to be more in a rehab setting, but that job was not available. There's not as many jobs available for that. And so then I was hired by a developmental preschool, which in Arkansas, there are a lot of developmental preschools, which I didn't realize in other states until I started kind of diving into some other states and learning more about therapy services there, that's not very common. So I started working for a developmental preschool in speech therapy. And at the time, so this was 2009. Okay. And the owners there at the time were very big into learning more about autism. So I feel like maybe 2009 is when, because I remember in coursework, I didn't have a class in autism. They do now because I actually just someone reached out to me recently at the university. But at the time, we didn't even have a course to learn more about it. When honestly, as a speech therapist, whenever I started, probably 60% of my caseload, that was the diagnosis that you have a serving. So anyway, they were offering, because we realized there was a big gap, a lot of continuing education. So they were flying people in to have like 3-day trainings. And so it just really started my love for learning more about the diagnosis of autism and trying to better serve these families and children. And so then just really that's where my love of just learning more and supporting autism started. Then I went and started working for another company. And we had a classroom that we realized, again, there's a gap. And so wanted to help better serve and support where we had lower ratios of kids in the classroom. And we had more therapists push into the classroom. And so, again, just more learning happened. And then I met someone that was a BCBA. And I remember she was observing our classroom because, like I said, many states don't have developmental preschools. So this was new to her because she was from Chicago. Yeah. And so when she came in, she was like, oh, have you been doing FBAs? And I'm like, trying to sit here, all my acronyms. I'm like, what is that? And and so then that's where I started wanting to learn more about it, because I never heard of ABA. I never heard of a BCBA, never heard of an FBA. I thought our classroom was so cool and we were doing so much support. And then I realized, wow, there's just so much more we can be doing. Again, too, like as a speech therapist, I was limited in my one-on-one minutes that I could serve or be one-on-one support with a child. And I just kept thinking, man, if I could have a little bit more time with them, how many more learning opportunities this kid could get? And I feel like then these skills, we know so much about early intervention, we could pick it up faster. And so then that just kind of snowballed everything into me then wanting to pursue treatment methods outside of the field of speech pathology. And so I became a board certified behavior analyst. I studied online with Ball State University, because at the time we had no universities in my state that offered this curriculum. And so when was that? So 2016 is when I became a board certified behavior analyst.
Nice.
And then, okay, so just a little bit more is that I then found a passion for teaching, because it's so like heavily parent involvement and parent training, and also training RBTs or behavior technicians. So then it found another love of like just sharing what I know and teaching others to help them have more strategies in their toolbox.
Love it. That is really awesome, you know. And first of all, you and I both went to the same college. So we went to Ball State.
No way.
Yeah, that's serious. I actually
were you 2016 too?
I became a BCBA in 2016. I graduated, I think, in 2014. So
okay,
it took me a little bit longer. Yeah.
Yes, I graduated because I took the test in May. So I graduated 2016. No, wait, I don't know when I graduated, but I took the test as soon as I could. And then luckily I only had to do that thing one time. That was hard.
Yeah.
That was hard.
Yeah.
No. And then
I cannot say the same myself. I did not pass on the first time, but you know, it took a little bit, but I was able to get there.
Well, listen, when I took it, it was back in the dinosaur days where I had to wait probably 3 months. I don't know, I'm exaggerating on that, but it's probably maybe 8 weeks, at least 6 weeks to find out if I did. And they didn't give me a score, because I was like, I know I passed this by 1 point, because that was hard. It was hard.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. No, I remember being anxiety ridden for weeks upon weeks.
Yes. Yes. And then you get an email and you still don't know. And then you read it and you're like, wait, did I read that right? I think I read it probably a million times. Cause then I told some people and I'm like, what if I told them wrong?
Oh my gosh.
But yeah. Well, that's so fun. I didn't realize. Yeah. So Ball State, I've never been there, just online.
Yeah, no, it's a beautiful campus too. I went there for my undergrad as well as my graduate. So
good.
Yeah.
Well, I really like the online program. The online program was tough. I feel like comparing the two, because I did in person for Masters for Speech, the online was really hard, because it was just, I think just online, it's a lot of work. And so you're not listening to lectures, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a lot of self-paced. It's a lot of like, you're doing it on your time. It's not like you're meeting for a lecture at 9 o'clock every day. You know, you are doing it on your time. If you have a job, or, cause in my case, I don't know about you, but I worked a full-time job in the middle of grad school. And so I did my schooling in the morning. So that way I could do cause I worked second shift. So I worked 3:30 to 11:30 over at a group home. And so I would basically do it like in between all of that. So it was hard. It was challenging.
Yes. Yes. Same. Definitely working and still trying to manage it all was a lot.
Oh yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, you mentioned something that, you know, speaks beyond truth. There really wasn't a whole lot of resources back then, you know, learning about autism, learning about ASD.
No. And if you really think about it, it wasn't that long ago. I mean, I know, like, I guess it was, but I just still sometimes I'm like, man, I can't believe that I kind of had the bones of what to do. And then when I came out, I was like, oh my goodness, this is majority of my caseload. I've got to, and that's what just shows you the whole importance of why we have to have continuing education, why you have to go and seek that out. You can't just rely on everything. Basically, what I've always told students that I've had, you're learning the bones. Like, you are not expected to know everything. What you're really learning is you need to know the bones of it, and you need to learn how to find out and then research on your own. That's all part of it, making sure that you're continuing that research and providing evidence-based practices, and where to find the answers when you don't have them. So
yeah, it's absolutely true. 15 years is both a very long time ago and it's very recent, especially in our field. Yes. You know, when you think about it,
it's just been crazy growth since 2016 for ABA. I feel like it's changed so much, and especially for our state. I think in our state that we had, I was trying to ask a colleague of mine, we did school together. I was like, do you remember how many BCBAs there were in our state? And she's like, oh goodness, I think 30. It might have even been less than that. So ABA in my state was not well known, definitely in 2016. It's really picking up and snowballing right now, just due to funding changes and all that as well, which has really helped it. But at the time in 2016, you know, we still didn't have all the funding for that too.
Absolutely. Even in like Florida, where we do have a lot more BCBAs, I think last I checked, we were in like the 20,000s or something like that for BCBAs. There's still a high amount of demand in this state. And really, like in general, there's still high demand like across the country. But even looking at my state, you know, looking at places like with mental health crises and, you know, group homes and things like that, like, there's a lot of need in those areas and not enough BCBAs to support, you know?
Right.
So
exactly.
It's crazy. So
I'm excited for where it's going. It's just, you know, right now it's, and then two, the BACB just trying to keep up with like that demand of how fast it's growing, where like SLPs, we've had ASHA for so long. And like, that's a lot, I'm sure, pressure on the BACB too, trying to keep up with, you know, the new task lists and how many new BCBAs and RBTs and like policies, and just with growth, that's just how policies a lot of times are created as well.
Absolutely.
Like, oh, we need a policy for this.
Absolutely. I mean, the changes that ABA has made just even within the last like 2 years, you know, it's kind of amazing. There are BCBAs who have come up to me and said, I've never really realized like the importance of ableism and client dignity to that extent. And it's like, you know, we've been, and even I've been taught, you have to follow through with the demand at all times. And it's like, whoa, you know, like the fact that this is very new, when it shouldn't be, but it is, you know, it's kind of crazy to even just like look at that, you know?
Yeah. And I think, you know, a lot of what I'm really excited about Greg Hanley's work and what he's been doing in like televisability and making sure that that is something that's on the forefront of, if it's not televisable, then, you know, should you be doing it?
Exactly. Are you truly engaging in ethical behavior? You know,
yes.
Absolutely. Well, tell me a little bit about how the integration of ABA, how has it sort of like helped with the developmental preschool program that you were a part of back then?
Yeah. So I feel like it's such a loaded question because we really didn't get started in this until late 2019. And then we all know what happened in 2020.
Yep.
Yeah. So, you know, we really, honestly, the integration of it into the developmental preschool is pretty new, like within the last, I feel like I've tried to not think about all that of like, I'm like, when did we start pushing back into the classrooms? Was it last year or 2 years ago? I can't remember now, but it's actually super new now of pushing more into the developmental preschool. So we started it with the, you know, intent of, you know, being more into the preschool programming. But then when that happened, we all had to segregate and separate and stay at a distance to where it was really, we had clinical on one end of the building and we had our preschool on one end. And then you literally checked them out and then you had them one-on-one and then brought them back. trying to just keep everybody separated. But now that we're kind of getting back in the swing of things and everything, it's kind of looking like it did, you know, pre-pandemic, but now we have ABA where we did not have ABA before. So OT, speech, and physical therapy have been very heavy in the developmental preschool space, you know, for, I don't know, since I've been out of school for speech for a really long time. So now it's kind of like now ABA stepping their toes in. And what does that look like? And so it's been really great. It's just been a lot more people because you've realized then you have your BCBAs, you have your RBTs. So I think a lot of that sometimes is what we're navigating through is just our rooms were built for this many people. And then now when you want to push in the classroom, it's more of a scheduling thing of like, okay, we can't have everybody in at once because then there's too many adults and too many kids in the classroom and then you can't move. So I think we kind of navigate that for the most part of it. And another part of it too is just figuring out too when to make sure that, you know, is learning still happening? Are we making sure that we are keeping that in mind? We're addressing any conditions that might be interfering with service delivery, which is part of our ethics code. And it's just navigating that and kind of like looking down at the schedule and seeing what's best to push in, what's best to pull out. And then two, you got to also keep it individualized. Is this an appropriate setting for this child? So for learning, not saying like, you know, the development of preschool isn't overall, but if they're in ABA services, is this going to be the best learning environment? And so that's something that the BCBA has to think of and look at when you're pulling in our ethics code for that is making sure like, when is the best time to push in? When, how do I train my staff to know like, okay, we were going to push in at this time, but it's actually not appropriate. We're seeing that they're getting very overwhelmed. We need to pull out. So a lot of that, normally what I've done in the past is I look at the classroom schedule. I then look at our schedule that changes constantly. Does y'all change constantly just with kids sick? Yeah. And so it's kind of navigating that. So I feel like the thing that's helped the most is we just highlight the schedule and say, okay, you know, at this point they're having circle time or centers. We have this goal and this goal. Let's try and tackle that at this time. These other times we need to, you know, pull out. And then we might have some smaller groups where I might try to pair them with another kiddo and another RBT that's, you know, they're developmentally on the same age. And I feel like what's been honestly been the most successful, and this is something that we kind of started during before we were pushing back into the classrooms, is a couple of BCBAs and I, we created some very routine based sessions. And we'll say this time of day, we're going to do this. Here's who's on the schedule and let's all come. So we have something we call like fun feeding. So we have our kids that are selective eaters or picky eaters, and we want to make sure we have that peer modeling, but the classroom at that time might just be a little too overwhelming and we might need 4 kids instead of 15 kids. And so it's a very routine, structured. We have the same beginning and end, which helps to decrease some anxiety about the unknown foods they might be being presented. It's like, okay, I know this is the beginning of where we're at and I know this is the end of it. And then we present some foods that hopefully have some similar properties that they already have in their repertoire that they're eating as well. We feel like that's been the most successful. It's just kind of having some of our own little groups too.
Yeah. And I can definitely see that. You know, you mentioned a lot of really good points, especially like within code 2.19, addressing conditions interfering with service delivery. You know, you do have to look at the environment. You do have to look at the number of people in the classroom.
And you have to look at it and you have to, it's like constantly evolving and changing. So it's like, you have to be able to train your staff to know that code and know, okay, here are some, like for one kid, I might say, here are some precursor behaviors. If we start to see these behaviors, then we know the classroom setting at this time is not beneficial today. But it's on your schedule. We're going to try it again tomorrow during this time because I see that is going to be appropriate for that child overall. But as we know, day-to-days are different. So then I might be like, hey, you know, mom, did they sleep last night? And then they're like, no, you know, we didn't sleep at all. And I'm like, okay, hey guys, we need a shift today. We're not going to push in as much because they had 1 hour of sleep last night. So they're going to need extra support today. And it's kind of just making sure that we are individualizing it and realizing what they need, but they might not need it at that day, that it's just going to be a difficult situation.
Absolutely. And, you know, we do have to consider that. We have to consider medical needs. You know, what if you have a child that has not just autism or not just a developmental disability, but what if they have like a physical disability, you know, such as like if they need a walker, if they use a wheelchair, if they have a feeding tube.
Yes. And we have that. That's a lot in our classrooms as well, that, you know, in the classrooms, we might have those that have more mobility or feeding tubes too. So then, you know, are we seeing like making sure that everyone else is safe, that if they are having a difficult time, we don't want to accidentally like anything to happen to anyone else in the classroom.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and it's so important to really make sure that we're identifying that, because that's going to help us be the most successful with our clients. You know, that's going to set our clients up for success.
But overall, the integration of ABA into developmental preschool, it's super awesome. Like, you have the opportunity whenever, sometimes when you're just in solely in a clinic, you're like, I'm a little limited. You know, I really want to prepare them as much as possible to go to kindergarten, because that's the setting that they're going to. And it really gives you that opportunity without having to leave this space that you're in. You know, but then you're able to also individualize it and tailor that individual program and plan for that child to help scaffold that for them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I know like sometimes in clinics, you know, when you're doing a one-to-one setting, you know, it's not nearly as natural as what real life is going to put you in. And so that's why it's so important to have those programs.
Listen, let me tell you, I started thinking about it. I think one of the hardest things too of pushing into the classroom, even as like just before as an SLP, is you don't realize how much waiting there is. So the kids, they're expected to wait a lot. And that's at no fault of anyone. It says you have 15 kids. We're passing out food. Okay. Yep. Now we all have to line up. Now everybody has to individually go to the bathroom on their own. And so sometimes you're kind of like, okay, this gets tricky on what programming, because I want to follow what they're doing. But then it's like, really, that's the expectation. That's what's going to happen in kindergarten. And you don't realize how much waiting kids do in the classroom. Or, you know, when they're going to be going to kindergarten, I'm like, this is a life skill that we're going to have to navigate through as well. Is just waiting our turn. You know, it's not my turn to grab my plate yet. I'm going to have to wait for Susie, Johnny, and Sally to get theirs first, and kind of waiting in line at the cafeteria and all that too. So it puts in perspective too, like how the classroom and what you really need to kind of sometimes focus on.
Yeah, it's absolutely truthful. And, you know, kind of on the line of collaboration. Mm-hmm. So in what ways have you seen ABA and speech therapy collaborate within the preschool setting? And how does it reflect the principles outlined in the Code of Ethics?
Yes, that's a really good one. And can there, I feel like two questions in that one. Can you repeat it one more time? Because I want to make sure that I'm answering.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So in what ways do ABA and speech therapy collaborate within preschool settings? Have you seen it that way? Mm-hmm. That's the first part. And then the second part is, how does this collaboration reflect the principles outlined in the BACD Code of Ethics?
Well, so I feel like, you know, so I have a collaboration course, and in that course, I really go through an article from ABAI, and it's really good. I don't know. Can you like in the show notes, like add an article?
Yeah. So what we can do is we can, link everything, when we promote. Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's really good. And I feel like it's one that everybody needs to read. It's really nice. So it really just talks about understanding the overlap between SLPs and, ABA.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot. Can you imagine that? There's a lot. Can you guess what our biggest overlap is?
Let's see. That's true.
Yeah. Communication, I feel like, is one of our biggest overlaps. I mean, we overlap in a lot, but I mean, I feel like that's our biggest one, is that making sure that we are collaborating on that area. 'Cause you don't want to be, you know, I'm reinforcing one thing and someone else is reinforcing another, because what's that going to lead to? Frustration on the client. So we want to make sure that we are all on the same page, not just in doing our own thing, because that's going to lead to further frustration for the client. And then they're not going to want to, you know, they might see you and they start shutting down because they're like, well, I get it with Miss Jenny. Why am I not getting it with you? So that's one of the biggest things why we really need to be making sure we're collaborating, that we're accepting the same form of communication, or we're shaping the same form of communication, or if we're accepting all modes of communication, what does that look like for this kid? And that we're all accepting and reinforcing that. And not only for that, is what's great for the developmental preschool, you're letting the teacher know too, what, hey, right, you know, he's doing this to request this. And I want to make sure we're honoring that. You're letting the parent know at pickup too. And so those are like some really big overlaps, and making sure that we kind of understand that piece as well.
Yeah. You know, I feel like between that and also employing different strategies too, and employing different, like the things that we're working on, like, for example, one of the clients that I work with goes to preschool, mm-hmm, and one of the things that they're working on is potty training, but yes, on our end, you know, we're not doing potty training until we know we have consistent staff, and the school's like, listen, just let us know when you're ready. And at that point, once we do it, then they do it. It kind of goes to show you how important it is.
Exactly. That's when parents say that they want to start potty training, the first thing I say is like, hey, I have to check with the classroom staff. If they're potty training two people and we only have one bathroom in that classroom, you know, here's some things that you can do at home of just like, you know, practicing sitting on the toilet, getting comfortable with the bathroom. But we all have to be on the same page, because the classroom staff, if they're here 40 hours a week, they can't support it at this moment. But not saying we're not, we're just going to get a plan in place and like have a plan for the parents. And so then too, that's getting to show you, like, Johnny's like, well, I do this at home and I'm doing this here. And it's just all around confusing for sure, little Johnny. We don't want little Johnny to be confused.
But absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Back to your question too, because I wanted to make sure that we are pulling in the ethics codes, you know, for this ethics CEU. You know, I mean, it basically says it in our code of ethics point blank, which is 2.10 of collaborating with colleagues, is that behavior analysts collaborate with colleagues with their own and other professions to best interests of the clients and stakeholders. So basically, BCBAs will address conflicts by compromising when possible. So I think that's one thing we need to make sure that we're keeping that in mind, and always prioritizing the best interests of the client. And so those are huge on that, of making it, I mean, it just says it right there, to make sure kind of what we were been discussing this whole time. If we can't sit here and be doing our own thing without everyone else doing it with us, or meeting together in the middle of, you know, what mode of communication are we going to do? What word approximations are we accepting? And then making sure that we're keeping up to date as those continue to progress as well.
Absolutely.
And I actually, you know, was on listening to a podcast, and Barbara Esch, I said her last name right. I always feel like. So she, you know, had talked about, she's a duly certified SLP and BCBA, and she had mentioned, and I thought this was a really great take on it, is that SLPs, so speech language pathologists, really know what to target as far as like communication. So from a like developmental standpoint, and BCBAs really know the how, like how to target it and how to shape that behavior. So like, for example, SLPs are more aware of developmental approach. So if the child is non-speaking, then we know typically development for language progression is we're going to start with the, you know, bilabial sounds such as M, B, and P. And some of those are the first developing sounds. And then we know then like targeting those syllables, then we're not going to target other sounds that are later developing. So like F or R or something like that. So really kind of knowing that piece. And then when we bring in BCBAs, they can really help us and have the tools of, you know, shaping the behavior, when to reinforce it accordingly, and finding out what's motivating too on how to reinforce it and when to reinforce it, so we can make sure that we are increasing the behavior as well. So it's like you just really want to just marry the two. And I felt like that was a great way that she presented that. And I was like, oh, yeah. I was like, that makes a lot of sense. So
it does.
Yeah. And I feel like too, like, I feel like I sometimes get stuck in my own perspective as, you know, an SLP and BCBA, Just hearing like your perspective, you had mentioned on a podcast that you work closely with the SLP on AAC and how helpful that was. And so from your perspective, what are your thoughts?
You know, it's so interesting that it's so interesting because the thing is, you know, one of the things that we want to make sure is we're practicing within our own scope. But at the same time, we also want to be able to learn more. AAC is not something that I'm completely well versed in, but it is something that I have grown a lot of exposure to working in different settings, working in different environments and with different types of clients. So for me, I feel like having that experience, and I've been very fortunate to work with many amazing SLPs, many amazing ones that are very open, but also at the same time have also helped me, have helped my past teams. And also, you know, just to give me more insight on how I can help my client set themselves up for success with communication. Because, you know, the thing is, like, everyone has their own different way of communication. All forms of communication are valid. And, you know, in my case, like, I may want to go one way, but for me to reach out to an SLP and be able to say, listen, you know, I would love to learn a little bit more from your perspective. You know, I feel like we all have to take a lesson in just hearing other people and getting other perspectives, you know?
Exactly. Like making sure that we're working as a team and we're doing it for the client. So I think sometimes when, you know, people are like, no, I'm going to do it this way, I'm like, are we really making sure that we're having the client in the center as a center bubble? And then remember, you're a branch out of this child's life. So like, can you imagine if you were, you know, having a surgery done and the surgeon's on one page, your anesthesiologist is on another page, you know, the nurse is on another page and they weren't working together, like that would not fly. So we got to make sure that we are working together. Because this is for our client and for them to, you know, succeed and help support the family. And there's just a lot more into it when you just really get out of your own head and your own discipline. You got to make sure you're looking at the child as a whole. What all is going on? Who all is involved? How can we be on the same page?
Absolutely. And the branch metaphor, that's such a good way to describe it. Because, you know, the child is essentially the tree. And everybody else is the branches, you know, parents are a branch, ABA, OT, psychology, SLP.
Yeah, there's so many involved. And I mean, if we're sitting here, you have to have a team approach for a diagnosis. Why are we not doing that for treatment?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and so that's why, like, for me, it's really quite a powerful thing. Coordination of care is so powerful in our field, you know, being able to just get the perspective of other people. Cause here's the thing, like, yes, I can sit here and I can come up with these strategies, but the thing is, if I don't know every element of my child's development and well-being, and, you know, if there's certain things that I don't know, then am I really doing my client the justice that they need?
Exactly.
Yeah. So that's really powerful. And on that note, we're going to go ahead and start with our first code word of the day. Our first code word is collaboration. So that is collaboration. That is collaboration. Make sure you have that written down so that way you can get your CEUs. So, speaking of collaboration, you know, of course, anytime that there's collaboration, you know, you might find that, okay, there are certain branches that are falling off, kind of like what you said, you know, someone might not be on the same page. Someone might be, you know, somewhere else. And so how have you, as both a BCBA and an SLP, worked to sort of like navigate those complexities?
Yes. So a lot of times it's just making sure that you are meeting and making sure that we're meeting and discussing the client. So, which can be really hard and really tough at times because sometimes you're not in the same building, but luckily for me, most of the time I am, but it's just making sure that you are taking that time and that opportunity to meet with them at some point so that you can be on the same page and making sure that we're collaborating together. And that's just going to, in turn, if you're meeting together and all on the same page, that's going to decrease a lot of challenges that you might have with different viewpoints or anything like that as well. And I feel like sometimes with that, like one of the biggest barriers is, you know, just different terminology. When we really kind of sit down, we might end up having the same, we might have be working on the same thing, but just having different terminology for that. So making sure that a lot of times we're coming into it and we're using more layman's terms and making sure that we're not using all this ABA jargon. There is so much ABA jargon, especially for parents or anything like that. When you're speaking to other professionals, you just want to make sure that you're really just kind of getting in there and let's talk about communication. Like, how are they requesting instead of manding and everything like that? Because they'd be like, okay, kind of like, you know, when I first met with FBA and she was like, are you doing any FBAs and using acronyms? And I still remember it. And I don't know why I felt it. I kind of felt like a little sweaty. I was like, I'm supposed to know what this means. She just said FBA and I should know what an FBA is. But I started going all in my brain, like, where is it? So then it kind of lost track of what we were even talking about. Right. So just showing, like, making sure that you are using layman's terms and bridging that gap and meeting together. And so I think the bottom line, though, is just making sure that we kind of just stop and get out of our own heads and making sure, you know, back to on the branch of the child that we're coming back together and meeting with that child. And I feel like that'll help navigate any challenges you have, is just having that open-mindedness and listening to other professionals, because other professionals are going to have different perspectives. They're going to have different theories. Remember, we have different schooling, and kind of tease it. And don't be afraid to ask, hey, why are you doing that? I do that with my OTs a lot. And I'm like, hey, I'm like, that what you're doing right there, like, I know what I would do with that, but why are you doing that? But, you know, asking kind of like, oh, okay, I never thought of it that way, of what you're really targeting or working on with that skill, and just being able to be open-minded to learning more that's outside of your field, to understanding their perspective and maybe what are their key goals as well.
Yeah, I feel like that is definitely something that, like, throughout my schooling, you know, we were always told, well, we need to just stay in our own lane and we need to just do it like this particular way. And ABA is what it is. And it's like, but the thing is, you know, as you're
it's
mentioning,
not who's all on team. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. It's not who's all on the team. And there's other perspectives, you know, open your brain a little bit. You know, there's more to the child than just doing this one specific way, this one cookie cutter way,
exactly,
in order for them to be setting themselves up for success.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. One thing I was curious about too, because, you know, you've worked in like that preschool setting. So how have you navigated those complexities between, you know, understanding like the scheduling and understanding like when there's too much going on, and also understanding too, like, at what point do we say, okay, maybe we need to fade back or choose something else?
And that's a great question. I feel like, you know, I kind of touched on it earlier too. It's just, it's all a juggling act, to be honest with you, because, you know, the complexities of it and having a clinic in the school setting is the same kind of as if you were in the clinic side, is one, you're assessing your child as soon as they come in the building. I feel like it's great to have just a quick little assessment with the parent of like, did they eat breakfast this morning? Did they eat dinner last night? You know, how was their sleep? You know, anything that might be some other underlying things that you might want to know going into the day, of like maybe how much support they might need, that might need to be added for them throughout the day, is like, you know, just some of those basic human needs. If we're not meeting those, then we're probably not going to be on our 100% A game coming into the day. And that's going to help you then determine throughout the day of like how then to schedule the child, of like navigating throughout the school setting and the clinic setting. Like, do we need to pull out more? Do we need to push in more and have some more smaller group or larger group activities for the child? And again, it just all depends on the child, where they are. So like, if I have a child on the VB map that's maybe, you know, scoring primarily in level one, that's probably not someone that I'm going to push in the school setting, because right now where I'm at with that child is I'm working on myself being the reinforcer. I'm then teaching them first that joint attention piece. I don't need all the other noise of in the school setting. So again, it's just individualizing it for what you need for the client and really looking at all the pieces. So you're just pulling that child, looking at all the pieces and deciding then where is the best place for service? What's going to interfere? Kind of going back to that 2.19. So addressing conditions interfering with service delivery. So like, you've got to make sure that you can assess that. And I feel like we do that really well as BCBAs, is we're really, you know, fine combing and pulling back the layers to figure out how best to support the children that we're serving.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I feel like in general, we have to really take a look at, you know, not only like the child, or not even the child setting, but the child themselves. And it's like, it should be common sense. It should be common sense to understand, hey, this is what we're supposed to do, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah, I definitely am right there. I mean, you know, especially too, in our code of ethics, 2.09 is heavily highlighted. You know, we have to make sure that we're involving clients and stakeholders throughout the entire service relationship, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's not just about you as a BCBA trying to employ all these strategies. It's the client also has to be involved at the end of the day. It's their treatment or their service.
Right.
So that's great. Yeah. Also too, I'm curious to know, you know, I'm curious to know, like, from your perspective, how does your experience as becoming a BCBA since 2016 inform your approach to addressing the unique needs of the children that you have worked with, especially like in the preschool setting?
This is a good question. So I think it's just having a different lens on what's going on. So I think what was eye-opening for me, and really, I forgot I even took in undergrad for SLP an intro to ABA course. That's what it was titled. But anyway, it's pretty similar. And I was like, oh, I forgot all about this. And then what was really eye-opening for me is just really breaking things down into ABCs. So you have your antecedent, your behavior, and your consequence. And really then evaluating, okay, this just happened as when I had the antecedent or my delivery of the consequence, but that's not the behavior I wanted. So what do I need to change and what do I need to alter in the environment to then get the behavior that I'm needing? So whether it's communication with a device or, you know, spoken language or anything like that, what am I now needing to change because I'm not getting the B part of it? So now that I really understand the A and the C, which I didn't so much as an SLP only. So again, kind of what going back to what I had said earlier that Barbara had mentioned is SLPs or BCBAs really knowing the how. So it's like, I know the what I'm wanting to target, but then I know the target that I'm wanting did not happen. So then how am I navigating that and changing my environment or the antecedent or the consequence to then increase or decrease that behavior? And in the preschool setting, that's just really helped support the teachers as well. So we had a kid one time, and I actually had a teacher stop me recently. I had done a training for them last summer, I think, and I had given this perspective of, we had a kiddo that every time he sat down in the classroom, he was given his carton of milk and he dumped it on a kid's head beside him. And so what do we keep doing? Handing him the carton of milk open. And right. So I was like, hey, let's change this. So instead of giving him the whole carton of milk, let's give him a cup and we're going to give him a small sip of milk. So then if he pours that, it's no big deal. Like, the person's not drenched, or like, you know, he can either drink it, or if he decides to pour it everywhere, then, you know, it's not a whole carton of milk. And then if he wants some more, we can just keep giving him more as he's consuming it. And so she came up to me, she's like, that was so eye-opening of just changing the behavior. If you want the behavior to change, well, then maybe I can alter something before it. And so that's really from a preschool age and, you know, helping supporting the teachers, help support them once I had that behavioral lens of helping support not just myself and my sessions, but supporting the classroom staff as well. So that's been fun of just being able to be a support for them and helping them to look at behaviors or like modifying things in the environment for them as well when they have such a busy classroom. And just a whole lot going on. And it's just like, let me help you out. Here are a couple things we can change. That's not going to be too much added work on you as well. There's so much. I mean, I feel like there's so much. I could go into this forever. But just like prompting, just the different prompting levels and fading out prompts and everything too. Just looking at data collection different. For some reason, I don't know. I got really stuck in grad school that I thought all my goals had to stay with 80% accuracy. And I was like, why am I doing this? Why did I not do this? And now it makes so much more sense. Now my kids are, you know, you really can see measurable progress a lot more when I've changed like how I'm just measuring their data. And it's made it so much easier during sessions too, of like, I'm not having to tally everything if it doesn't need to be tallied. And taking that frequency data and everything and like, hey, let's just take some rate of responding on this. And so it's been great on that, you know, task analysis, backward chaining, forward chaining, all that's been just huge since learning it and like being able to apply it and helping support other SLPs and some of the things that they're doing as well.
Absolutely. You know, and you know, it's so great that you talk about helping other people out in the classroom. You know, helping the paraprofessionals, the teachers, because it does get to be a very busy environment.
It's so overwhelming. So then anything you could do to help a teacher out, like help them out, like it's a lot. It's very taxing, very stimulating. So can you imagine, like, I feel very overstimulated sometimes at the end of the day for myself. Just probably like, I need no noise for the rest of the night.
I hear that.
Anything that they can, you know, get, they need it. So support your teachers.
For sure. Cannot express that even more. Huh. You know, and also one thing to think about with collaborating, not just with colleagues, but also with parents and caregivers. You know, I feel like that parents and caregivers can sort of be missed at times when it comes to the collaboration with others. You know, so when it comes to not just collaborating with your colleagues, but collaborating with caregivers as well, what role do they play within this? And how do you ensure that their involvement is active while still respecting their priorities?
Yes. So I think the biggest way is one, you just have to have to parent buy-in. So if you're not going to respect their priorities, you're not going to have any kind of, they're going to be like, okay, whatever. I'm not doing anything because you're not respecting what I just said was very valuable and important to me. So I think it's first then is just meeting with a parent, discussing, you know, what is, you know, your biggest thing that you want support in and figuring out how to navigate that in a behavior analytic way. So, you know, in the setting that I'm in for preschool, typically a lot of times it's potty training. And so it's like, okay, you know, where I would have started might have been here, but I'm hearing that this is a big struggle for them. We're going to start here. And then once I have their buy-in, we're going to circle back in and get to more some ABA principles or behavior principles. And I think a lot of times starting out that new BCBAs might start with like, oh, you have to be able to define this and define what task analysis and chaining is because it's on our insurance forms. But I think that's where we're getting lost is we're trying to make sure that we're checking off our boxes to make sure we have appropriate funding, but then we're getting lost in what's the biggest perspective. And again, go back to our, you know, circle. Our circle is our kid and then branching out to the parents who they're with the most and making sure you're going to have the most impact when you have the parent buy-in. And to have the parent buy-in is you're showing value of what they're seeing as the most valuable and important to them to learn at that moment. And then you can sprinkle in those other things after you have that buy-in and you've helped them with something that maybe they've been struggling with for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I feel like that buy-in is just huge. You know, you can't get ABA services or really any service without buy-in.
No. You know? And it's just taking the extra time of, like, you know, sending them videos. I feel like video modeling is so underutilized. If you want a parent to do something, they love videos of their kids. Show them what you're doing. Send them a quick video. And then you're going to have more buy-in of them trying that at home as well, especially when they see that it's successful. Because a lot of parents are like, they don't do that with me. And be like, hey, you know, try this. You know, let's just change this little bit up and then you can try this at home.
Yeah.
Another way to have more buy-in, and I feel like has been really successful for me in this setting where I'm not in the home, is sitting and making parent goals together. So yeah. If you're making them together, then you're going to ensure that you're going to have, you know, that you're making sure that you have client dignity and all that, and that you're seeing what's most important to them as well.
Absolutely.
And that increases that involvement with them too.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And then they feel like they're part of a team, kind of what we've been talking about this whole time with collaboration. Parents are part of that team too. And so if they're accepting a different form of communication than what you're teaching them, why are you teaching them that? Because they have to be on board too.
Exactly. Exactly. And on the note of team, I'm going to go ahead and present our second and final code word. That code word is teamwork. That is TEAMWORK. That is teamwork. So make sure you have that code in so that way you can get your free CEUs. Yeah, you know, it's really so true that, you know, it does take, there's a quote, it takes a village to raise a child.
Yes, it does.
And let me tell you, you know, like everyone plays a very important part of their child's services at the end of the day. And so it's really such a beautiful thing to see this collaboration come together, you know, mm-hmm. when it happens, of course.
Yeah, because if you really like take a step back, put yourself in the parent's perspective, how overwhelming is it to get a diagnosis, then know you've got to then go and seek out services. You have so many expertise, so many different people are telling you different things, but they might not be communicating together and looking and making sure that they're all on the same page. It's like, well, OT just told me this, but you just told me this. And I'm just very confused on, I'm trying to seek the best services for my child and I'm trying to do research and everything is saying the opposite or saying different things and no one's on the same page. And I feel like that's kind of confusing. And I feel like that's kind of where the online space is right now. And I just wish we could all get on the same page because our overall goal is our clients are our why. We want to make sure that we are improving and we are helping support them to be as independent and live happy lives and with the families too, because that's very stressful when, you know, you're trying to find services for yourself and other people are not on the same page.
Absolutely. If your client's not your why, then chances are you probably aren't in the right field, you know, and I mean that with all due respect, but also too, it's like, you know, your clients are the bread and butter. They're the ones that you're going to be catering to. You're not catering to yourself. You're not catering to your ego. You're catering to a very unrepresented population, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's definitely very important to take note of. So, and finally, you know, one of my last questions here, how do you stay updated with evolving practices and regulations within the field of ABA?
So that's a great question. Well, one, the BACB is really good about sending out things, but it's just so hard because I feel like your states are different. So it's all with your funding source. So making sure that you are, you know, making sure that you are looking into that and you're advocating for the needs of the clients that you serve. The company that I work for, the owners are amazing and they really heavily legislate for a lot of things. That's how we now have ABA services covered under Medicaid where it never had been before. And so it's just a lot of meetings, making sure you're going and advocating, and then you have to stay up to date to it. So, you know, I don't know if we talked about this earlier, but Medicaid started covering ABA services for us in 2019. Which then had a boost of it coming in into the preschools, but we were servicing before, but it was just with insurance. And so with that, you know, one, ABA is growing crazy. And so it's just making sure that you are contacting them. Like, what are you expecting? What do you need to make sure that we're going to get adequate funding? So there are no gaps in coverages or gaps in services. So a lot of it is just you have to reach out to your state representatives, to Medicaid, But luckily, I don't have to do a whole lot of that. I attend meetings where we have, you know, our overhead and owners that they're going and seeking out all that information and relaying to us BCBAs, since, you know, we have a lot already on our plate. And so they're like, okay, we've found this out. This is now what we need to put in reports or what we're needing to do to make sure that we're continuing funding for that child. So I'm just really fortunate for that, because that alone, like, that's a lot, that's a full-time job in itself. So if, it's really hard to be able to maintain your caseload as a BCBA and solely doing that as well. So when you have a company that's helping do that, it's really, really fortunate.
That's beautiful. And, you know, you're absolutely right about really making sure that you're keeping up with your state laws and your state representatives as much as possible, because, you know, ABA, even though ABA is finally being recognized by insurance funders, it's still important to make sure that we advocate for our clients' rights. You know, there's still
a lot. Continuation of services, just because it's offered now doesn't mean it's going to continue. So you've got to make sure that you're having that voice for, and you're advocating for those that are unable to do so for themselves.
Absolutely. I think ABA services under certain, I want to say, like, in Florida, it's up until like 22 or 23, or I don't remember the exact age, but, you know, it's not forever. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, our autistic children, our intellectually and developmentally disabled children, cannot have access to the service, after so long, you know, and even with waivers and stuff, there's a huge wait list, at least down in Florida. There is, it's like a 10 plus year wait list.
It's unfortunate. And hopefully as the field is growing, that we're going to see those wait lists go down, because there is definitely a big gap for those that, you know, it's like, well, I have a diagnosis now, but now I can't get services. You know, we now have the funding for it, but now we don't have the staff. You know, we're not, our state is still behind in having enough BCBAs to service what now is able to be funded. But, you know, I think we're all seeing that we're on the right path. Our universities are seeing that this is something that we need to offer. And, you know, we have two universities that are now offering coursework. We might have one more that's looking into it, but, so it's growing and we're moving in the right direction. So that's good for our state.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I feel like as long as we continue to sort of like open our eyes and sort of like, you know, understand a little bit more about the needs of intellectually and developmentally disabled people, and also kind of like get ourselves more educated about the needs, we can definitely continue to make that growth.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Jenny, it has been an absolute pleasure speaking with you today. I'm so happy that we got to do this interview. And also too, where can our guests find you?
Thanks so much for having me. This has been fun. I'm very passionate about collaboration. So where you can find me is, I am on Instagram as Jenny Northern Services. I like to, have some funny reels just to, you know, change up the day and share some of what I'm passionate about on there. I also have a course on collaboration as well. If you're interested in that, you can look it up on Instagram, but that's pretty much where you can find me right now.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Jenny. And thank you everyone for tuning in. I have been your host, Michelle Zeman, and I will see you on the next one. Bye.